thanks for our lives here in America and for the good fortune of living close to one another. Then we talk about turkeys. Turkeys have no flavor. The trimmings are worse. Do Americans like turkey? I don't think they do. Meanwhile, all the food, including the turkey and trimmings, gets eaten, and we all share the American tradition of feeling more stuffed than the bird. Then it's time for dessert. Baklava, fruit, pastries, and pumpkin pie, which we serve with Persian ice cream. With its chunks of cream, roasted pistachios, and aromatic cardamom, Persian ice cream serves as a reminder that Persia was once one of the greatest empires in the world. I believe peace in the Middle East could be achieved if the various leaders held their discussions in front of a giant bowl of Persian ice cream, each leader with his own silver spoon. Political differences would melt with every mouthful. During our Thanksgiving meal, my father gives thanks for living in a free country where he can vote. I always share gratitude for being able to pursue my hopes and dreams, despite being female. My relatives and I are proud to be Iranian, but we also give tremendous thanks for our lives in America, a nation where freedom reigns. But although land of the free refers to the essential freedoms that make this country the greatest democracy on earth, it could also refer to the abundance of free samples available throughout this great land. In our homeland, people who taste something before they buy it are called shoplifters. Here, a person can taste something, not buy it, and still have the clerk wish him a nice day. A few months ago, my father mentioned that he had gone out to lunch with his brother, Nematullah. I was quite surprised because my father's idea of eating out is going to sisters' houses. My two aunts, who live in small, modest homes with tiny kitchens, are always ready to serve whoever drops by around mealtime, a term loosely defined as anywhere between breakfast and bedtime, give or take 2 hours. Their generosity and genuine delight in feeding others prove my theory that the more modest and impractical the kitchen, the more likely one will be invited to stay for a meal. Show me a fancy house with a top-of-the-line gourmet kitchen, and I'll show you a family that eats out a lot. "So where did you go?" I asked my father. "Price Club," he said. Price Club is a chain of huge warehouses that sells items in large quantities. Toilet paper comes in packages of 36 rolls, and one box of muffin mix yields 144 muffins. As far as I know, Price Club has no restaurant. Puzzled, I probed further. "What did you eat there?" "Samples," he replied. "Price Club has samples, rows and rows of endless samples. Itching to try the latest frozen chicken burrito or those mini hot dogs that come in mini buns? How about some instant soup, ice cream sandwiches, spaghetti sauce, or pork buns? It's all there, and it's all free. The mind-boggling generosity even extends to second and third helpings. I have witnessed people hanging around the Mrs. Fields sample table far longer than it takes to actually chew one and walk away. These anonymous people who shamelessly eat their way through the store now have a face, my father's. "So what did you actually eat?" I inquired. "I don't know," he replied. "It all tasted the same." Under normal circumstances, my father would not eat a frozen Western-style fish enchilada. But give him a free sample and all rules of judgment and taste are suspended. The same goes for airline food. Once he finishes his own tray, he is more than happy to finish ours. "You're not going to eat that?" he asks, referring to whatever the rest of us have found to be inedible. "Give it to me." My father is every flight attendant's dream, simplifying the stacking process by thoroughly emptying each tray. A few years ago, my brother Fashid sent my parents on a first-class vacation to Japan. They weren't as impressed by Japan as they were by the food service in first class. My father did admit, though, that he felt ill after the flight. "I ate nonstop," he said. When my parents returned from their trip, they presented me with, among other gifts, 14 mini jars of jam. "What are these from?" I asked. "Breakfast in the airplane," my mother replied. "We each got 2 jars. "What about the other 10 jars? I asked, not wanting to know the answer. "Those are from the other passengers who didn't want theirs." I envisioned the first-class passengers spreading their cloth napkins on their laps when suddenly, "Do you want the jelly?" My mother, with her thick Middle Eastern accent, could just as easily have asked for their passports, which the passengers would have handed over gladly just to get rid of her. It is fair to assume that by the time my parents shuffled off the airplane, their pockets laden with a bounty of wrapped sugar cubes and tiny bottles of ketchup, the entire cabin knew that my parents usually fly coach. My parents' hunting and gathering instincts are not limited to the freebies in first class. They also get their money's worth in coach. My children know that a visit from their grandparents means a dozen packets of American Airlines peanuts. How do they get so many? My mother has a system. I tell them that I'm visiting my grandkids and they love peanuts. I assume that works better than telling the truth. I'm paying $150 for this seat and I would like the equivalent in free food. Evidently, my parents are not the only ones unable to resist the pull of a free meal. Denny's, one of my father's favorite American restaurants, serves free birthday meals. Denny's assumes, of course, that nobody would go to eat a birthday meal alone. It is fair to expect that a person celebrating his birthday would bring along a few paying friends. Of course, there is an exception to every rule, and Kazem is his name. My father has no idea of his exact birth date. Whenever a child was born in his family, someone made a notation in the family Quran. The flaw in this system became apparent when someone lost the Quran. My father and his siblings have had to rely on one another's memories to approximate their ages. He was born the year of the flood, which makes him 75. No, that can't be right. He was born the year I learned how to read, so he's 77. No, he was born the year all the chickens died. He's 71, maybe 72. When my parents were coming to America, my father had to choose a birth date. Ever the practical man, he decided on March 18th, my mother's birthday. This way, he figured, filling out paperwork would be considerably easier since he would only have to remember one date. His system was flawless until Denny's marketing gurus started offering those free birthday meals. Every March 18th, my parents would experience the same scene. "Isn't that adorable?" the waitress always said. "Matching birthdays! Hey, Oscar, check this out!" To get their free chicken fried steak, my parents had to endure the inquisition. "How did you two meet? When did you realize you have the same birthday? That is the cutest thing I have ever seen." Rather than go into the whole, "We somehow lost the Quran and that's why we have the same birthday" story, my parents just smiled and hoped the waitress would go away. Eventually, my father decided to go to Denny's alone on his birthday, thus avoiding the entire "ain't it romantic to have the same birthday" scenario. When my father retired, he found himself with lots of free time. Retirement traditionally brings out men's true passions: golfing, fishing, spelunking. Ever since he retired, what was once a mere pastime of my father's has now become a full-time mania that can be summed up in one word: timeshares. My parents still live in Newport Beach, an affluent community full of tanned, yacht-loving, tennis-playing people named Fritz and Binky. My parents have nothing in common with any other resident of the town. They're not rich. They play no sports, and I'm quite sure that neither one knows how to spell or pronounce yacht. But they have one thing in common with their neighbors: a zip code that means money. My parents are regular targets for marketers looking to sell anything to presumably wealthy retirees. When my father was working, my mother got rid of the nasty telemarketers with a standard response delivered in her thick accent: "I am the maid." Any mail soliciting anything was thrown away before my father came home. All this changed after my father retired. Now a cheerful, eager immigrant greets any marketer who calls the house. People hawking timeshares are the most insidious, luring their prospective victims with far more than the usual free t-shirt or can opener. They offer everything from a free overnight stay at a nice hotel to a free dinner to a $50 gift certificate. All you have to do is attend one of their seminars, which are basically long infomercials without the benefit of a mute button. Far better trained than the CIA and more persistent than Hare Krishnas, these salespeople know how to corner their unsuspecting prey and make them sign away their life savings. One minute, you're laughing with the nice salesperson. The next minute, you own a timeshare in Des Moines. Somehow, my parents survived their first timeshare experience without buying anything, but the sales tactics were so forceful that my mother swore she would never go again. My father, the taste of the free filet mignon still lingering in his mouth, wasn't ready to quit. He was upset that my mother did not want to make timeshares a regular part of their twilight years. "Why can't you just go and have a good time?" he asked her. Perhaps the same can be asked of patients going to the dentist for root canals. Timeshare seminars have a certain addictive quality. Unable to convince my mother to join him, my father recruited Uncle Nematullah, who brought with him the added advantage of speaking less English than my mother. This was a good thing, since his inability to understand the sales pitches rendered him far less likely to sign on any dotted line. My uncle just wanted to know when their free lunch would be served. My father and uncle managed to see Palm Springs for free twice. All we had to do was listen to 2 half-day seminars. It was great. They also saw San Diego and Santa Barbara, courtesy of timeshare seminars. They did, of course, give up several days of their life, but as my uncle said, "I'm recording all the shows we're missing on my VCR." Once they had honed their skills, their tactics were simple. As my father explained to me, "I just go and tell them I have no money and my brother doesn't understand English." Sadly enough, my uncle Nematullah recently decided to return to Iran. This departure has left my father without a partner in crime. Despite his persistence, his sisters refused to join him because, frankly, they're too smart. My father, never one to give up hope, recently announced that he is trying to convince my mother to give timeshares another chance. "If she understood less English, she would enjoy the seminars a lot more," he told me. In the meantime, he has a lot more time for his other hobby, watching television, which, unlike yachting, fishing, or spelunking, is completely free. The Ham Amendment. One of my father's favorite foods is ham. This is not a problem if your name is Bob and you live in Alabama. But when you're Kazem living in Abadan, satisfying your ham cravings can be a challenge. During my childhood, Iran was a monarchy led by the Shah. His picture was everywhere. The serious expression on his face made it clear that this was an important person having important thoughts. His beautiful wife, Farah, was usually seen standing beside him in photos, wearing a large, bejeweled crown, which appeared rather uncomfortable, but managed to make her, too, look far more important than the average person walking down the street. They had 4 children, all of whom were envied by the entire Iranian population for leading perfect lives, lives which included French-speaking nannies, skiing lessons, fancy clothes, and the assumption of perpetual happiness. I didn't really think much about the royal family, except I had noticed that they owned a lot of big jewelry. My parents, however, were huge fans. My father firmly believed that the Shah would educate and modernize Iran. After his graduate years in Texas, my father had returned to Iran full of American optimism. With its vast oil reserves and abundance of smart people, Iran, according to my father, could really go places. When I was 5 years old, the Shah was scheduled to come to Abadan for the inauguration of the petrochemical plant. A parade had been arranged and a special float had been built for him. To avoid the large crowds, we decided to skip the parade, knowing that we would not be able to see anything. We were not, however, willing to miss our only opportunity for a brush with royalty. My father, a man whose engineering mind always comes up with a solution, devised a plan. On a scorching hot day, the day before the parade, my mother wore her Jackie Kennedy sleeveless dress. My brothers put on long-sleeved shirts and ties, and the 5 of us drove to the parade site in my father's air-conditioned Chevrolet. Granted, there was no parade, no cheering crowd, no music, and least of all, no royalty, but none of that mattered. We climbed on the beribboned float intended for the Shah, our faces protected by the awning built to shield the royal face from the blazing sun. We smiled. My father's camera captured our royal moment. What brought the Shah to Abadan was its seemingly endless oil supply. This natural gift was a mixed blessing, a bit like having a garden that stands out in the entire neighborhood. You know that eventually somebody's going to come and pick your flowers while you're sleeping. In our case, it was the British who came for the oil. The British were the first to realize the huge financial potential of the vast Iranian oil reserves. With the sound of cash registers ringing in executives' ears, British Petroleum negotiated an agreement with the Iranian government that allowed the British to drill for and sell the oil in exchange for a small sum. In a perfect world, the kindergarten teacher would have stood up before any documents were signed and said, "Time out for Britain. We'll renegotiate after a nap." But alas, with no teacher present to remind the participants of the universal concept of fairness, the British applied a different universal concept, greed. The agreement between British Petroleum and the government of Iran was destined for disaster. Fortunately, exploitation has a limited shelf life, and Iranians eventually woke up. In the early 1950s, the Prime Minister, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, nationalized Iran's oil. The British were forced to leave Iran. Unwilling to simply walk away from the golden egg-laying goose, the foreign oil companies banded together and boycotted Iranian oil, resulting in a huge economic downturn. Within 2 years after the nationalization of its oil, the Iranian economy lay in shambles. Political upheaval ensued. Once again, Iran was ripe for foreign exploitation. This time, with foreign powers working behind the scene, Dr. Mossadegh, the national hero, was ousted. History partly repeated itself, and the foreign oil companies once again took over the operation and exploitation of the Iranian oil industry. This time, however, Iran received a larger portion of the profits and more control over oil operations. By the time I was born in Abadan in 1965, there was no longer a large British population in town. A few foreigners remained, all employed by the operating companies. Iran was finally reaping most of the profits from its own oil. In the absence of the British, the residents of Abadan benefited from a city built by thoughtful British planners. We had swimming pools, clubhouses, and very orderly housing developments. My hometown looked different from any other Iranian city. Catering to the European expatriates, some stores in Abadan carried foreign goods, exotic products such as Ovaltine, Kit Kat candy bars, and ham. Even with the British gone, their canned and boxed foods remained in the stores, serving as a reminder of the exotic world that existed outside our borders. During his graduate years in America, my father had been deprived of his beloved Persian food. No steaming platters of saffron-infused rice, no tender chicken kebabs, no marinated lamb shanks with eggplant stew. Exhibiting the survival instinct of adaptation, he had developed a taste for cafeteria food, in particular jello and ham. After his return to Iran and subsequent marriage, he had convinced my mother to make jello on a fairly regular basis. I liked the wiggly stuff, but I preferred to eat the powder raw out of the palm of my hand. My father's ham cravings, however, were a different story. My mother would not touch the stuff with a 10-meter pole. She cringed at even the word jambon, the French word used in Iran for ham. I had no idea why my mother reacted so strongly. All I knew was that whenever my father wanted to buy ham, I was his chosen partner, and I was honored. The opportunity to spend time alone with my father was so rare that I would have done just about anything to have him all to myself. Had he wanted to rob a bank, I would happily have driven the getaway car. Unlike the Persian markets, where the fruits and vegetables were openly displayed, the tiny grocery stores that sold ham carried foods veiled in boxes and cans. Pictures hinted at the contents, although there was no rooster in the cornflakes. An air of mystery hung around these exotic foreign products, many of which had pictures of smiling people on the containers. None of the people looked Iranian, which led me to the obvious conclusion that there were a lot of happy people living in other countries. Once the ham was purchased, my father and I rode home, sharing the excitement felt by cavemen who had successfully hunted the elusive mammoth. My mother and brothers stayed away from the kitchen while my father meticulously prepared his meal with fresh tomatoes, pickles, and onions. He then sat down to savor every mouthful while I watched him. Eating his beloved jambon always put him in a good mood, which then led to stories about America and his exciting graduate years. I never asked to eat the ham, and my dad never offered. Having been part of the hunt was satisfying enough for me. When I started first grade, I began studying Islam in school 1 hour per week. We studied the history of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. We learned about the Prophet Muhammad and the Imams. All the stories were marvelous until the lecture about forbidden foods. To my complete shock, I discovered that my own father was destined to a very bad place for a very long time. All of a sudden, our ham excursions no longer seemed fun and innocent. I now understood why my mother wouldn't even look at the stuff. She was trying to save her soul. I rushed home that day with an assignment far more important than my math homework. I was determined to alter the course of my father's afterlife. As soon as my father's car turned into our driveway, I ran out and told him of the unpleasant future that awaited him forever. He let out a hearty laugh. I started to cry. Once my father saw my tears, he sat down with me and said, "Firuzeh, when the Prophet Muhammad forbade ham, it was because people did not know how to cook it properly, and many people became sick as a result of eating it." The Prophet, who was a kind and gentle man, wanted to protect people from harm, so he did what made sense at the time. But now, people know how to prepare ham safely, so if the Prophet were alive today, he would change that rule. He continued, "It's not what we eat or don't eat that makes us good people. It's how we treat one another. As you grow older, you'll find that people of every religion think they're the best. But that's not true. There are good and bad people in every religion. Just because someone is Muslim, Jewish, or Christian doesn't mean a thing. You have to look and see what's in their hearts. That's the only thing that matters, and that's the only detail God cares about." I was 6 years old, and I knew that I had just been made privy to something very big and important, something far bigger than the jewels in the Shah's crown, something larger than my little life in Abadan. My father's words felt scandalous, yet utterly and completely true. In the midst of my thoughtfulness, I heard my father continue, "And when you're older, Firuzeh, I'll have you try something really delicious. Grilled lobster." Treasure Island. When he was growing up in Ahvaz, one of my father's greatest joys was going to the movies. Had it been up to him, he would have happily spent his entire childhood in front of the big screen, dreaming his life away. But movies require a ticket, and tickets cost money. My father's father, Javad, owned wheat fields outside Ahvaz. When it rained, the wheat grew and there was money for movies, sometimes three in 1 month. When it didn't rain, which was often in Ahvaz's arid climate, money was scarce. My father grew up looking at clouds and always hoping for rain. Because there was no air conditioning, movies were shown outdoors in the summer. This meant that certain risk-taking people, like my Uncle Mohammed, could climb on high walls and rooftops to watch the movies for free. My father, having inherited the cautious and law-abiding genes in the family, could never quite gather the courage to join his older brother on these free movie escapades, even though he really, really wanted to see the films. His older brother finally persuaded him to live a little and join him on his favorite wall for a night at the movies. My father gave in. Just as the two of them were nesting comfortably, along came a police officer. My Uncle Muhammad immediately jumped down and ran away, leaving my panic-stricken father abandoned like a fledgling on a high branch. The policeman, waving his stick, yelled at my father to get down or else. Trembling, he closed his eyes and jumped right into a pile of bricks. He ran away bleeding all the way home. The deep gash in his shin eventually became infected, and my father was told he might end up losing his lower leg. After 6 months, the cut finally healed, but it left behind a scar that is still visible. The movie theater showed a different film every week. There were the Egyptian movies, usually involving a lovelorn couple, an obstacle in the guise of a mean father, a jealous neighbor, or an illness, and the eventual death of one of the lovers. My father hated these tearjerkers because no matter how hard he tried to resist, he inevitably left the theater in tears. His favorites were the American Westerns, where the good guys always won. He also loved Tarzan, a movie so popular that it had to be shown for several weeks in a row. But my father's all-time favorite movie was the 1934 Treasure Island. After seeing that movie, he decided that his goal was to find a treasure, something that would alter the course of his life forever. And this he did. The treasure he found was not buried, but rather taped on a wall. It was a poster announcing a competition for Fulbright grants. At the time, my father was 23 years old and teaching mathematics and engineering in Abidjan. He immediately filled out the form and started dreaming about studying in America. One of his colleagues shattered his fantasies by telling him that Fulbright grants were only for the sons of senators and other rich people. "You don't stand a chance, cousin." My father was ready to abandon his dreams and end the application process, except that he had already asked his boss for a day off to take the Fulbright exam, and he was afraid that if he skipped the exam, his boss would think that he had lied just to get a day of vacation. So he, along with hundreds of others thirsting for an education abroad, took the exam. When the results were announced, my father's name was first on the list of people who had passed. My father, however, was still convinced that in the end, he would be passed over for the son of a rich family. When he was asked to make a choice of schools in America, he said it didn't matter. He just wanted somewhere warm like Ahvaz that had a farming program, since he figured that animals spoke the same language everywhere, even in America. He also said he wanted to study engineering. A few months later, six of his colleagues received news that they had been awarded Fulbrights. My father's classes ended for summer vacation, and he accepted an engineering position. A month later, during a trip to the post office, the postal clerk informed my father that he had received a letter about a month earlier that could not be delivered. Apparently, the letter was addressed to the school, but since my father was no longer teaching, the post office had not delivered it. The clerk handed my father an envelope. It was his acceptance letter to Texas A&M, courtesy of a Fulbright grant, along with a scholarship from the Ford Foundation. The letter stated that he was expected in Texas by a certain date for a 40-day orientation program. My father looked at the calendar. That certain date had been a week ago. Frantic, he ran to his boss and asked for 5 days off. Having never set foot outside Iran, he needed to go to Tehran to obtain a passport. He didn't quit his job, fearing that having missed the orientation, he might have lost the scholarship. In Tehran, he headed straight to the passport office and handed the administrator his identification booklet. The administrator leafed through it, handed it back to my father and said, "I'm sorry, there's a page missing." Sure enough, the last page, the death certificate, was missing. "But I'm alive," my father pleaded. No matter. He was told he had to obtain another identification booklet, a process that takes 3 months. My father's 5-day trip to Tehran turned into a 25-day stay, during which he ran around frantically recounting his story to everyone, hoping that someone might know someone who might be able to expedite the process. A kind administrator finally decided to help, supplying him with an identification booklet within a week. He then obtained a passport. Next stop was the American Embassy, where he was issued a visa within a couple of hours. He then returned to Abidjan, quit his job, bid a teary goodbye to Sister Sedire and her family, and boarded a plane bound for Texas. By the time he arrived in Austin, he had already missed 35 days of the 40-day orientation. For the remaining 5 days, he was assigned to a room with a Japanese student who found Americans morally bankrupt. For 5 days, my father listened to his roommate pontificate on the dangers of their new, loose surroundings. On the last night of orientation, during the farewell dinner, one student became completely drunk, draped a tablecloth over his body, and danced wildly on the tables. He was hauled away by the organizers, but not before my father recognized the wild and crazy guy as his roommate. Throughout the school year, my father studied on weekdays. On weekends, he studied some more. The combination of being shy, not knowing English well, and missing most of the orientation proved to be a recipe for loneliness. During one long weekend, another of the Fulbright students barged into my father's room and announced that he could no longer take the loneliness and would be abandoning his studies to return home. My father tried to dissuade him, but in view of Kazem's thick accent and his unique flair with the English language, it's anybody's guess what actually came out of his mouth. Anyway, the student went back home. A few days later, my father noticed a large envelope addressed to the departed student. Accidentally opening other people's mail has always been one of my father's favorite hobbies. The envelope contained a letter from the Fulbright office, letting the student know that he could transfer to any school he chose and that any accommodation would be made to ensure a memorable experience. This gave my father a brilliant idea. He decided he wanted to transfer to another school with a livelier environment, but he didn't want to ask directly for a transfer. He wanted the committee to suggest it. So he painstakingly wrote a letter describing how lonely he was. The Fulbright office responded immediately, telling him that he had been assigned an American hostess who would show him around town on weekends. This is not what my father had had in mind. The following Saturday, he found himself standing in the lobby of an art museum. His hostess had obviously thought that as an engineering student, my father could benefit from a bit of culture. Little did she know that the only culture my father was interested in was the kind in yogurt. My one memory of a family excursion to an art museum ended with my father asking, "Do we have to pay to get into this place?" After half a dozen culturally enriching weekends, my father decided that the merits of loneliness were highly underrated. Given the choice between spending time with a kind soul who had given up her weekends for some engineer from a country she had never heard of, or reading, say, theories about fluid mechanics, his decision was obvious. My father informed the Fulbright office that, thank you very much, he had been cured of his loneliness. A few weeks before spring vacation, one of my father's engineering professors asked him if he had any plans to go away for Easter break. He did not. So the professor invited my father to accompany him and another professor to Princeton, New Jersey. Having noticed my father's passion for math and engineering, as well as his tendency to spend long stretches of time alone, they had thought he might want to come along. My father happily accepted, knowing that this was going to be much better than hanging out in art museums. During the long car drive, the professors explained that they would be having a reunion with an old acquaintance. They had attended a seminar taught by this remarkable man years ago and had decided to pay him another visit. After 3 days of driving, they arrived in New Jersey. The next day, with my father in tow, the two professors headed to meet their teacher. The year was 1953. Albert Einstein possessed, according to my father, deep, penetrating eyes. He spoke in a deliberate and gentle manner. One of the professors introduced a Fulbright scholar from Iran. Professor Einstein asked my father to tell him a little bit about the Fulbright program, the key words here being little bit. My father told him about the history of the grants and how Senator Fulbright had started them after World War II as a means of fostering understanding between the United States and other countries. Kazem said he hadn't believed that a teacher in Abadan would be selected for such a prestigious grant, even though he really was qualified. He told Einstein he had always dreamed of studying in America, how wonderful everything was, and that was just the beginning. Here was a lonely foreigner who had basically spent an entire year not talking to anyone, but who had suddenly decided to spring a year's allotment of conversation on an unsuspecting genius. One can only imagine what was going through Albert Einstein's brilliant mind. Never ask about Fulbrights again. Once the soliloquy was completed, Kazem asked Professor Einstein if he knew anything about Iran. He was looking for an excuse to segue into his scintillating speech on the petroleum industry in Iran, its past, its present, and its future. But God was clearly smiling on Albert Einstein, who unintentionally threw Kazem for a loop. "I know about your famous carpets and your beautiful cats." That put an end to the conversation, since my father had no idea what he meant by these beautiful cats and was not about to ask. When trying to impress the likes of Albert Einstein, one pretends to know what the genius is talking about, especially when it pertains to the country one is representing, thanks to a Fulbright grant. So my father said what he always says when he has no idea what the other person is talking about. Yes, yes. My father returned to Texas a much happier man. His meeting with Albert Einstein had confirmed his suspicion that anything is possible in America. He spent the next few months finishing his studies and getting ready to return to Abadan, where he looked forward to feeling once again the warmth and kindness of his siblings. He was, however, returning with more than just a diploma. He also had a new dream in which the treasure was no longer buried. He dreamed that someday he would return to America with his own children, and they, the children of an engineer from Abadan, would have access to the same educational opportunities as anybody else, even the sons of senators and the rich. It was a dream that my brothers and I were honored to fulfill. It's all relatives. It's said that Inuits have more than 20 words for snow. This seems logical, given that the average Alaskan spends a lifetime surrounded by snow, observing details that the rest of us have never noticed. Having spent my adolescence in Newport Beach, I learned the many nuances of tan. I learned the difference between a deep tan, a fading tan, a bronze tan, and a new tan. No one would be caught dead with a farmer's tan, which is a tan showing the outline of a t-shirt and shorts. Even worse is a fake and bake, one acquired in a tanning booth. A surfer's tan is the most desirable, since it also comes with sun-bleached hair. Growing up in Iran, I was surrounded not by snow or tanned people, but by relatives. Not surprisingly, my native language, Persian, contains many more precise words for relatives than does the English language. My father's brothers are my amu. My mother's brother is a dayi. My aunt's husbands are either shohar ame or shohar khale, depending on which side of the family they are from. In English, all these men are simply my uncles. Only one word describes their children in English, cousin, whereas in Persian, we have 8 words to describe the exact relationship of each cousin. When we lived in Abadan, we lived near my father's oldest sister, Sedire. She is my ame, my father's sister. Her 4 sons are my pisar ame, sons of father's sisters. Our family spent every free moment together, and I always thought of my Aunt Sedire and Uncle Abdullah as a second set of parents. Since my Aunt Sedire never had a daughter, she regarded me as her own. Always warm and affectionate, she showered me with compliments that stayed with me long after our visits had ended. She often told me that I was smart and patient, and that she wished that I were her daughter. She never criticized me, but loved me as only a father's sister could. To me, the word amme still conjures up feelings of being enveloped with love. Aunt Sedire also had a beautiful garden full of nasturtiums, roses, snapdragons, and sweet peas, a veritable Disneyland for the olfactory sense. We went to her house for lunch every Friday. While the smells of her cooking filled the house, I would go into her garden and smell every flower over and over again. Even though I went there weekly, each visit to her garden was as exciting as the first. When we moved to America, I no longer had access to those fragrances, and I forgot all about my aunt's garden. Strolling through a market in Berkeley one day, I spotted a vaguely familiar flower. I bent down and smelled a sweet pea for the first time in 15 years. Suddenly, I was 6 years old again and running around chasing butterflies in my aunt's garden. After lunch at my aunt's house, the adults napped, and I embarked on my favorite adventure, going into my Uncle Abdullah's library. Uncle Abdullah, my shohar ame, was a man of books, a learned man who enjoyed learning for its own sake. Fluent in Arabic, he had a particular interest in linguistic roots. In his thirst for knowledge, he stood alone. Potatoes, radishes, and turnips were the only roots my family cared about. I, however, was fascinated by his interest in words, although I could never understand his explanations. If I asked him the meaning of a word in Persian, he would explain its Arabic etymology, giving endless examples of words sharing the same root. He would then discuss the word's evolution into its present form and throw in a few quotes from the Quran for good measure. By the time my uncle finished explaining, I had usually forgotten my question. Nonetheless, I was entirely fascinated by his passion for words and by how much he knew. In my uncle's library, I always headed straight for the collected Reader's Digest, which I liked for two reasons. They were small, and they arrived in the mail every month from America. I did not know a word of English, yet I enjoyed studying the child-sized magazines from cover to cover, trying to figure out what the stories were about. I always made sure to put them back in the exact order in which I had found them, for fear of losing the privilege of browsing in my uncle's library. Years later, after we moved to America, my father bought me my own subscription to Reader's Digest, an event that remains the high point of my life in junior high. Aunt Sadira and Uncle Abdullah now live near my parents in Southern California. Even though their condominium has only a tiny garden, they have managed to cultivate an enviable cornucopia of figs, pomegranates, sweet lemons, and herbs. My aunt is still a wonderful cook, and no visit to Southern California would ever be complete without her lentil saffron rice, her eggplant stew with beef shank, or her signature oven-cooked salmon stuffed with homegrown herbs. My sweet Aunt Miss still delivers her kind compliments, but nowadays she tells me what a good mother I am, and I tell her what a compliment that is coming from her. Uncle Abdullah is a translator, a job that allows him to surround himself with his beloved words. His passions, however, have broadened to include computers, which he discovered when he was well into his 70s. This means that whenever my husband, the software engineer, visits Southern California, he spends hours with Abdullah trying to retrieve lost and deleted files. "I don't know how it happened," my uncle always says. My husband reminds him, "When the computer asks, 'Are you sure you want to delete this file?' just say no." "It doesn't ask me," my uncle always replies. "They just disappear." My aunt and uncle have four sons, Muhammad, Mahmoud, Mehdi, and Mehrdad, all of whom are married with children of their own. Even though my father considers all his nieces and nephews to be his own kids, he is particularly close to his sister Sadira's children because they live near us in Abadan, allowing my father the pleasure of watching his nephews grow up. He loves recounting endless stories about each one, emphasizing their unusual intelligence, wit, and charm. "We've already heard that one," we tell him, but my father never hears us. For in recounting his stories, he relives the sweetest moments of his life. In return, his nephews adore him. When my parents want to go on a great vacation, they visit Mehdi, who is a professor in Austria. "Mehdi knows how to show us a good time," they always say. When they want any kind of medical advice, they ask Mahmoud, the orthopedic surgeon, the best surgeon ever, according to them. When my parents want hospitality, they visit Muhammad, whose kindness and generosity remind my parents of their lives back in Abadan. And for entertainment, they always visit Mehdad, who is their unofficial third son and the proud father of the only two red-headed members of our family. "His kids could be models," boast my parents. After the Iranian Revolution, my father, unable to find a job in Southern California, had stayed with Mehdi's family while working in Northern California. Mehdi's oldest son, Daryush, and Daryush's younger brother, Ryan, had moved into one room so that my father could have his own room. 20 years later, my husband and I cleared out a room in our house so Daryush could stay with us while working as an intern at a nearby computer firm. "I guess it's payback time," he said when he arrived. We all laughed, knowing that the thread of kindness and generosity in our family has no beginning and no end. "Just make sure you have room in your house," I told Daryush. "Someday my kids will be coming." When Daryush's grandmother Sedire was a young girl, she was, according to my father, the smartest one of all. Times being what they were, Sedire was not allowed to pursue her education past sixth grade and was married shortly thereafter. All her brothers became engineers and doctors. My father found this a huge injustice. He always told me that if his sister had been able to pursue her education, she would have become the best doctor of them all. For not only was she smart, she was resourceful as well. He loved to tell the story of how one year all the family's chickens were dying and nobody knew why. Sidire was determined to find the cause. She began to observe the chickens closely and noticed that they appeared to have trouble swallowing. She then performed an autopsy on one of the dead chicks and discovered a tumor in its throat. She then took each chick that was still alive, made a small incision in its throat, removed the tumor, and sewed it back up. They all survived. Whenever my father told me this story, his eyes welled up. "What an injustice to deny a mind like that an education," he always said, his voice getting smaller and smaller before he exclaimed, "And you, Firuze, you will go to a university." My father could not change the past, but the past had most certainly changed him. "I don't care if you do nothing with your college diploma, but you will have one," he adamantly declared. It was payback time for my father, whose daughter was destined to claim the education denied his sister. My oldest paternal uncle, Mohammed, did become a doctor, the first in the family. As a young doctor, he supported his younger siblings, enabling them to continue their education. My amu had a successful practice in Ahvaz and enjoyed a life of luxury up until the Iranian Revolution. He and his family fled to America in 1980 with just a few belongings. Mohammed's Iranian medical license did not allow him to practice in America, so he had to take both English and medical courses and pass the necessary exams. At 58, an age when most doctors are thinking of retirement, my uncle had to spend a year as an intern, the oldest one in the hospital. After completing his education, he set up a practice in Southern California, joining the ranks of other hard-working immigrants pursuing the American dream. Eventually, he managed to create a lifestyle somewhat like the one he left in Iran. He even bought a Mercedes, which, unlike his Mercedes in Iran, he has to drive himself. My father always says that his brother made the family proud twice, once as a young man when he became a doctor, and once as a not-so-young man when he became a doctor for the second time. Uncle Mohammed is our family's symbol of perseverance. All of my amme and amu live within 15 minutes of one another and manage to get together for every possible occasion, from birthdays to that long-standing favorite, the Miss America pageant. My amu Mohammed recently turned 80, an event that the family celebrated with a Hawaiian-themed birthday party. 70 family members spanning 3 generations attended. Uncle Mohammed gave a speech and announced that he would never retire. The family cheered. As boring as graduation ceremonies are, my relatives attend every one, rejoicing in the academic accomplishments of the children and grandchildren. Nobody understands the graduation speeches, but everyone goes to clap and cheer. Like all Iranians, we consider academics to be of the utmost importance. Almost every child in my extended family has attended college, a record that brings tears of pride and joy to the eyes of the older generation, a record that we hope to continue. My relatives also attend one another's housewarming parties, New Year celebrations, and baby showers, all en masse. Recently, my pisar amu, the son of my father's brother, moved into an apartment near UCLA to begin dental school. His father threw him a housewarming party, and 50 members of the family showed up to celebrate in his tiny apartment. "It was great," my father said. My father and his siblings drive one another to doctor's appointments and pick one another up from the airport. If one goes for a checkup, they all call for the results. They know which one of them has high blood pressure and which one is allergic to dairy products. They know one another's favorite foods and often use the knowledge to lure one another for visits. "Kazem, I just made rice pudding," is my Aunt Sedira's way of inviting my father over. His other sister, Fatime, has her own equally effective siren song, "Kazem, the mulberries are ripe." Together, my relatives form an alliance that represents a genuine and enduring love of family, one that sustains them through difficulties and gives them reasons to celebrate during good times. My father and his siblings have even purchased burial plots together, because as my father told me, we never want to be separated. Uncle Muhammad, the oldest doctor, purchased a plot high on the hill with a view of the Pacific Ocean. I've always wanted an ocean view, he says. Before I married Francois, I told him that I came with a tribe, a free set of Ginsu knives with every purchase, so to speak. Francois said he loved tribes, especially mine. Now, whenever we visit my relatives, all of whom dote on my husband, I realize that he didn't marry me despite my tribe. He married me because of them. Without my relatives, I am but a thread. Together, we form a colorful and elaborate Persian carpet. Me and Bob Hope. The great American philosopher Dr. Seuss once wrote about a fellow named the Grinch, who for some mysterious reason did not enjoy Christmas. Dr. Seuss tried to delve deep into the unfestive mind of this enigmatic creature in order to find a possible reason for his lack of Christmas spirit. It could be his head wasn't screwed on just right. It could be, perhaps, that his shoes were too tight. These are fine explanations, but to me, the obvious answer was overlooked. Perhaps the Grinch was, like me, a Muslim, someone who was left out of all Christmas festivities. The problem with the religious explanation is obvious. Nothing rhymes with Muslim. At least if you're Jewish, you can feel bluish during Christmas. But with Muslim, you're just stuck. When I lived in Iran, the country was predominantly, but not entirely, Muslim. Iranian Jews and Christians worshipped in peace. My family and I were secular Muslims, like most of the population. My parents' idea of being religious consisted of donating a part of their income to the poor and not eating ham. The only women who chose to cover themselves head to toe with a chador were either older women or villagers. In the cities, Iranian women preferred to dress like Jackie Kennedy or Elizabeth Taylor. In school, one of the subjects we studied was religion. We learned not only about Islam, but also about Judaism, Christianity, and Buddhism. We were taught to practice Islam, but to respect all religions. Knowledge of Islam was mandatory for all Muslim students. Its practice was not. The Christian and Jewish children at my school were exempt from religious studies, a fact that caused much envy among the rest of us. When we moved to America, I discovered that school was much more fun here. There was less homework, no endless math drills, and no memorization of famous poems. I loved my teacher, Mrs. Sandberg. I loved Girl Scouts, the Whittier Public Library, and Butterfinger candy bars. I loved Halloween, the Brady Bunch, and free toys in cereal boxes. It seemed to me that life in America was one long series of festivities, all of them celebrated with merriment and chocolate. The laughter, however, stopped when we reached Christmas. All of a sudden, everyone was having a party, and I was not invited. In Iran, the biggest holiday is Nowruz, New Year's Day. Since it is a secular holiday, Nowruz is celebrated by the entire country, as Thanksgiving is in the United States. It always begins on the first day of spring at the exact moment of the equinox. This means that every year Nowruz begins at a different time. One year it might be March 21st at 5:32 a.m., while the next year it might occur on March 20th at 11:54 p.m. Every Iranian knows the exact moment the jubilation begins. The festivities are preceded by weeks of preparation. Everyone thoroughly cleans his house, buys or makes new clothes, and bakes traditional pastries. A ceremonial setting called a haftsin, which consists of seven symbols beginning with the sound S, is displayed along with other meaningful objects like a mirror, colored eggs, and goldfish in a bowl. The objects represent health, renewal, prosperity, fertility, and the usual universal hopes shared by people at any New Year's celebration. Unlike the traditional American New Year's wishes, however, The Persian New Year holds no symbols of hope representing losing 10 pounds or getting in shape. For Nowruz, most businesses close and the streets are deserted. For 12 days after the equinox, people visit relatives and friends, always starting with the eldest. Once all the elders have been visited, they in turn visit the younger members of the family. At every house, a tray of homemade sweets is offered, along with wishes for the new year. Children receive money, always in the form of brand new bills. I assume that since the wave of immigration after 1980, banks in America have noticed a sudden increase in demand for crisp bills in the month of March. But when we moved to America in 1972, Nowruz lost all its meaning. No longer did we feel the excitement building toward the big day. No longer did we see people cleaning their drapes, buying new clothes, or sweeping their yards spotless. No longer did we prepare for an onslaught of visitors. Gone were the smells of pastries coming from every kitchen. Gone were the purple hyacinths that decorated every house. Gone were the strangers wishing us Nowruz Mubarak, Happy New Year. Gone was the excitement in the air. In America, we have tried our best to celebrate Nowruz, but it's a challenge. Since it's not an American holiday, everyone is either at work or in school. It's hard to get in the mood when your national holiday falls somewhere between soccer practice and the dentist appointment. However, now that there are more Iranian immigrants in America, it is becoming far more enjoyable to celebrate Nowruz. I'm sure that Macy's Nowruz sale is not too far behind. In America, Christmas is the king of all holidays. To be left out of Christmas is the ultimate minority experience. As an adolescent, I learned to commiserate with my Jewish friends. Together, we talked about how we couldn't wait for December 26th, how we hated hearing Christmas songs everywhere, and how we wished that our mothers would just once bake us Christmas cookies. Although I enjoyed kvetching with my Jewish friends, I was not convinced that they could thoroughly feel my pain. They, after all, had Hanukkah, which, even though it's completely different from Christmas, still involves food, clothing, presents, and light. At my house, December could have just as easily been August, since there was absolutely no sign of any festivities. Christmas vacation was a long, boring holiday. In Iran, whenever we had free time, we got together with relatives. In America, whenever we had free time, we watched television. Christmas for us meant an evening spent with Bob Hope, John Denver, Sonny and Cher, Tony Orlando and Don, and any other celebrity who managed to have a Christmas special. We weren't picky. If it was on, we watched. My parents, however, had a particular fondness for the annual Bob Hope Christmas specials with frequent guest star Brooke Shields. They didn't understand any of Bob's jokes, but my father laughed along with the laugh tracks. Then my father would ask, "Inchigoft? What did he say?" And that was how I spent Christmas Eve, translating Bob Hope's jokes into Persian, jokes that my parents didn't understand in any language. Of course, for my father, Bob Hope was more than just a comedian. He was a dignified older man who wore sharp suits, had great posture, and managed to be witty without ever getting nervous. I think that secretly, my father wanted to be Bob Hope. My mother thought Brooke Shields, in the dozen different outfits she wore for each show, was the embodiment of perfection. I could not understand why Brooke, who is the same age as I am, never went through an awkward adolescent stage. I wished I could be Brooke Shields. So did my mom. In between all the song and dance numbers, we watched endless commercials for all the wonderful gifts that we were not going to receive, and made plans for the after Christmas sales, a celebration that unites all religions. During the month of December, people constantly wished us Merry Christmas in that automatic way. If we said that we didn't celebrate Christmas, we received a cheery Happy Hanukkah. Call us Scrooge, but we didn't celebrate that one either. Then what do you celebrate? We were always asked. Nothing, we'd say. What are you? Muslim. A few brave souls inquired further, usually academic types or residents of Berkeley. The average citizen, however, smiled and said, "Oh," and left. When I married a Catholic, I became a card-carrying member of the Christmas Club. Now, every December, my children and I drag a tree into our house, leaving a trail of pine needles should the tree need to find its way back. We decorate the tree with ornaments that take up half of our closet space, eat Christmas cookies that help us grow in both spirit and girth, and read Christmas